morning. This is the KBOO News for Thursday, November 16th, 2006. A solid hour of news in just the 30 minutes. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Steve Bowow. In Oregon, House Democrats plan to keep caucus meetings closed.
An American soldier pleaded guilty to taking part in the rape of an Iraqi girl and the murder of her family.
In Baghdad, there is a widespread disagreement over the details of the mass kidnapping at a Ministry of Education building this week.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, chance of showers, highs 50 to 55 tonight. Mostly cloudy again, chance of showers, lows in the 40s. Democrats who will be running the Oregon House for the first time since 1990 say one thing will be kept the same. Caucus meetings, where lawmakers often strategize over top issues, will remain closed. Democrats are pledging to have one of the most open Congresses and sessions in years, however. House Speaker-elect Jeff Merkley and other Democrats said that keeping those meetings closed to the public and news reporters will promote more candid communication among House members and better lawmaking. When the legislature is in session, lawmakers often break into groups along party lines and conduct separate caucus meetings, which often occur before regular floor sessions. House Democrats, who met this past weekend to elect their leaders for the 2007 session, did not formally vote to close the caucus meetings to news media coverage. State Republicans have never opened caucus meetings to reporters, and except for a few isolated instances, House Republicans and Democrats have kept their caucus meetings closed.
Intel, Oregon's largest private employer, said this week that it employed more than 16,000 workers in the state at the end of October. Almost half of the 830 job cuts have come since the end of September. Intel is eliminating 10,000 jobs worldwide. It is the largest streamlining maneuver yet for a company that had swollen to more than 100,000 workers. New Intel processors introduced last summer have restored the company's technological edge, but industry analysts say AMD's resurgence presents a long-term problem for Intel that could limit its growth and eat into its profit margins. The cut started in July when Intel laid off 1,000 managers across the company. In September, the company announced a second round of layoffs as part of a restructuring plan that will continue into the middle of 2007. This from the Oregonian.
An administrative law judge has recommended that Klamath Farmers' request for continued cut rate electricity to pump irrigation water be turned down by the California Public Utility Commission. Administrative law judge Michael Galvin found that the Klamath Water Users Association could not document any benefit to PacifiCorp, the owner of four hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River, from water that first runs through the federal irrigation project straddling the Oregon and California border. A final decision from the commission is not likely for at least a month. If it goes through, farmers would wind up paying slightly more per kilowatt hour for their water. Conservationists, commercial fishermen, and Indian tribes hope that paying more to pump water will force farmers in the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation to use less water for irrigation, leaving more for Klamath River salmon and waterfowl on nearby national wildlife refuges. Farmers argued that water will now be recirculated around the project multiple times rather than being pumped uphill to the refuges and the river. PacifiCorp spokesman David Cummey said from Portland that the recommendation would restore fairness to ratepayers in the region because any continued subsidy of the Klamath irrigators would have to come from increased rates from other customers.
Oregonians are throwing stuff away faster than they can recycle it. A new Oregon Department of Environmental Quality report shows that in 2005, Oregonians generated 5.5 million tons of trash, an increase of 6% from the previous year's figure. Although Oregonians are also shown to do a better job than ever at recycling, the increase in volume of waste far outweighed the increase in recycling. There is a troublesome and growing gap between the tons of trash produced and the tons recovered or reclaimed for the new uses. It reflects a modern age of relative prosperity and, with more and bigger houses to build and fill, increasing consumption. During 2005, Oregonians recycled slightly more than 49% of the material they threw away, exceeding the 45% mandated by the 2001 Oregon legislature. Residents of the Portland area recycle or recover almost 59% of the material they discard. But the net increase in waste means that Oregon has failed to meet a goal set by the 2001 legislature, that there would be no increase in waste in 2005. This from the Oregonian.
In Portland, a group of environmental science students from Westview High School are joining a regional project that drafts local students to assess local streams and explore ways to make them healthier. Working under the guidance of Portland State University, high school students from Vancouver to Estacada are performing water tests, mapping stream beds, and counting aquatic insects. They are gathering data that local agencies need but cannot always get themselves. Other Westview students a few years ago found high levels of phosphorus polluting a tributary of a creek. After tracing it to fertilizer washing off a soccer field, they persuaded the Parks District to install artificial turf that doesn't need fertilizing. The value of the study rests not only in data from the Westview students, but also the combined data collected by all students who participated in the region-wide study known as the Student Watershed Research Project. The kids' work offers a running barometer of the health not only of Willow Creek, but also the entire watershed surrounding it. This from the Oregonian.
Andy Clark, who heads the League of American Cyclists, said that he won't advocate that freeways become bike paths after last Tuesday's elections. But cycling enthusiasts are dreaming big after their three biggest supporters in Congress, including two from Oregon, were swept into powerful new transportation positions after the Democrats took control of the U.S. House. Representative Jim Oberstar of Minnesota is in line to become the chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Representative Peter DeFazio, a one-time bike mechanic, expects to chair the Surface Transportation Subcommittee. And Representative Earl Blumenauer, founder of the Congressional Bicycle Caucus, will either hold a senior position on the Transportation Committee or move to the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee. All three Democrats are strong supporters of alternative transportation who believe that bicycling can play an important role in moving people, particularly in dense urban settings and in providing recreational opportunities. This, according to the Oregonian.
You know my motor won't even turn. You know my starter won't start this morning. You know my motor won't even turn.
Clear Channel Communications today agreed to be taken private for nearly $19 billion by an investment group. Clear Channel said the deal calls for a group led by Thomas H. Lee Partners and Bain Capital Partners to pay about $38 per share in cash for Clear Channel common stock. Clear Channel announced in late October that its board of directors was evaluating strategic alternatives to enhance shareholder value.
Democrats move towards picking a top lieutenant to Speaker-to-be Nancy Pelosi and hope to put to rest a politically costly family feud that intensified just days after they reclaimed the House from GOP control. Pelosi passed over Steny Hoyer of Maryland, now the assistant minority leader, and endorsed longtime ally John Murtha of Pennsylvania to become the majority leader, the powerful number two party post in the House. Yet Murtha could prove to be a problematic candidate because of his penchant for trading votes for pork projects and his ties to the Abscam bribery sting in 1980, the only lawmaker involved who wasn't charged.
A U.S. soldier yesterday pleaded guilty to taking part in the rape of an Iraqi teenage girl and the murder of her family. Specialist James Barker, being tried at a military court in Kentucky, entered the plea to avoid the death penalty. Barker is one of four U.S. soldiers charged with premeditated murder over the rape and killing of a 14-year-old Abir Qasim al-Janabi, her parents, and her 6-year-old sister. Barker has agreed to cooperate with prosecutors and testify against his fellow accused, Private Jesse Spielman, Private Brian Hauer, Sergeant Paul Cortez, and former Private Stephen Green. His civilian lawyer, David Sheldon, said his client's guilty plea was in exchange for a sentence lighter than the death penalty. The soldiers are also accused of burning Abir's body in an effort to conceal evidence. Barker is the first soldier to plead guilty in the crimes. Sergeant Cortez, who faces the death penalty, has deferred entering a plea. At a preliminary hearing at a military court in Baghdad in August, Barker provided evidence about the rape and murders in a written statement. It is alleged that Green claimed to have been the ringleader, had repeatedly told his comrades that he wanted to kill some Iraqis. This, according to The Guardian.
American civil rights lawyers expressed outrage yesterday at a Justice Department court motion arguing that immigrants living in the U.S. could be held indefinitely on suspicion of terrorism and had no right to challenge their imprisonment in court. The motion was filed by the administration on Monday in the case of Ali Saleh Khaled Al-Mahri, a Qatar citizen studying in the U.S. who was arrested in 2001 and accused of being an Al-Qaeda sleeper agent. He is being held in a military prison in South Carolina. The six-page Justice Department motion argued that under an anti-terrorist law passed last month, he was an unlawful enemy combatant who had no right to challenge his imprisonment in civilian courts. Instead, the motion said, his imprisonment would be reviewed by military tribunal. But critics of the law, the Military Commissions Act, said that the tribunals did not meet American or international standards of justice. Monday's motion made it clear that the U.S. government intended the term enemy combatant could apply to immigrants living legally in the USA, as much as to gunmen captured on distant battlefields. The Justice Department also noted that the new law applies to all enemy combatants, regardless of the location of the detention. It makes no distinction between prisons in the U.S. and Guantanamo Bay. This from The Guardian.
The U.S. Republican defeat in the November 7th elections seems to be hitting Miami's anti-Cuban right-wing groups in South Florida pretty hard. In spite of the million Cubans who are currently living in the metropolitan zone of Miami, the three candidates that were running hardly achieved 200,000 votes against unknown adversaries with ridiculous budgets and without support from their party. Democracy Believers PAC has granted $5,000 to the fund of legal expenses by Tom DeLay, who abandoned his post due to accusations of corruption, money laundering, and illegal electoral finance. This from Prensa Latina.
Environmental leaders say that when the 110th Congress opens in January, they are planning to play offensive for the first time in years. They will focus on energy, global warming, a reauthorization of the Farm Bill, conserving national parks and other public lands, and protecting endangered species. Phil Clapp, president of the National Environmental Trust, said the world is watching to see if the change in Congress can change U.S. climate policy. Most other developed countries, including the European Union countries and Japan, are bound by the protocol, which expires at the end of 2012. It requires an average cut in greenhouse gases of some percentage below 1990 levels, but is widely viewed as a first very small step towards controlling global warming. In an international climate talks in Nairobi, a second commitment period to begin in 2013 is under discussion. This from the Environmental News Service.
On November 4th, 2006, Chicago activist, artist, and musician Malachi Richard immolated himself along Chicago's Kennedy Expressway. He was motivated by an abiding moral outrage at the United States' occupation of Iraq. He published a personal statement and self-written obituary on his website, savagesound.com. Next to his body was found a videotape and a small sign on which the phrase, "Thou shalt not kill," was printed. The story received virtually no national coverage and extremely limited local attention. The article was buried in the back pages of the Chicago Tribune. It has been discussed at length, however, on blogs. This story comes from Chicago Indie Media, Chicago Free Press, and other sources.
The town council in Greenleaf, Idaho, has okayed a new gun law. It all but requires every homeowner to have one. There's an exception for people who have strong objections because of religious beliefs, for instance, but the idea is to help make sure town residents can protect themselves from outsiders if need be. Citing Hurricane Katrina, the measure sponsor says, we could get refugees. The law is kind of redundant. About 80% of Greenlee's adults already own guns. The mayor says he owns about 25. Still, Greenleaf doesn't have a big crime problem. It was founded by pacifist Quakers, and the most violent offense reported in the past 2 years was a fistfight.
In San Francisco, a California sea lion has bitten at least 14 people and chased 10 others out of the water this week at a public park's lagoon. This has prompted the city to temporarily close the area to swimmers. No serious injuries have been reported, but officials decided to ban swimming at the aquatic park lagoon yesterday until the testy marine mammal has moved on. Experts say the rogue sea lion could be protecting his harem of mates or might have brain damage from toxic algae. Marine Mammal Center veterinarian Frances Gillen said the animal may soon leave the area and advised swimmers to avoid the lagoon in the meantime.
A woman was killed and two people, including the bodyguard on the Israeli defense minister, were seriously injured today when more than a dozen rockets were fired at Israel from Gaza. The rockets were aimed at Sderot and Ashkelon and prompted calls for Israel to invade the Gaza Strip again to prevent more such attacks. Israeli forces have just completed a week-long occupation of the town of Beit Hanun, in which more than 60 people were killed. The occupation was meant to stop the firing of rockets, but they appear to have become more accurate. In recent weeks, a higher proportion have landed in built-up areas rather than farmland. It is the first time since July 2005 that the crude Palestinian rockets have claimed a victim. The rockets have killed a total of 9 people since they were first fired in 2001. Islamic Jihad and Hamas claimed responsibility, claiming retaliation for Israel's killing of 19 civilians when its artillery shells misfired. Israeli attacks are responsible for the deaths of thousands of Palestinian civilians. This, according to The Guardian.
A dispute has broken out between Iraqi officials over the number of hostages seized by gunmen in a raid on government offices in Baghdad this week. Higher Education Minister Abd Diab said 150 people were taken captive and that 70 to 80 were still being held. But the Prime Minister's office said that out of a group of 40 hostages, no more than 5 were still being held. The abductions were carried out by gunmen wearing uniforms newly designed for Interior Ministry police commandos. Sunni politicians say Tuesday's incident at the Higher Education Ministry building shows that the Iraqi police are colluding with Shia militias. The Interior Ministry, which runs the police force, is assigned to Shia politicians, while the head of Higher Education Ministry and many of its employees are Sunnis. Baghdad has been plagued by sectarian violence between Sunni and Shia communities. Hundreds die every month. Killings are blamed on Shia militias, and bomb attacks are blamed on Sunni militant groups. This from the BBC.
Every day, Iraqi families are packing their bags and emigrating to escape the violence tearing their country apart. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, estimates that 1.8 million people have fled to neighboring countries and 1.6 million have been internally displaced since the American invasion. In 2006 alone, 425,000 Iraqis sought refuge abroad. Most go to Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. Syria is popular because its habits and traditions are similar to those in Iraq, and living costs are relatively low. Saeed hopes to rent a flat for US$200 a month, a third less than a comparable apartment in an Iraqi Kurdistan, where growing numbers of Iraqis are flocking. Few of the emigrants can afford airfares, so they risk traveling overland by buses and taxis, passing through lawless areas where insurgents and criminals operate freely. This, according to the Environmental News Service.
A man who was arrested after he was spotted on a highway overpass dressed as Osama bin Laden on Halloween faces additional charges for the stunt. Tom Connolly was charged yesterday with terrorizing and reckless conduct in addition to the original charge of criminal threatening. Prosecutor Stephanie Anderson said all three charges are misdemeanors. Police responded to calls from motorists on Interstate 295 about a man on an overpass wearing a white robe and carrying a fake assault rifle. The costume included a rubber mask, plastic dynamite, and grenades, in addition to the toy assault rifle. Before the man was arrested, he walked towards officers, and police said Connolly created an incredibly dangerous situation for motorists. Connolly's lawyer, Daniel Knight, said yesterday that there was no mistaking Connolly for a terrorist on Halloween. Connolly was holding a sign with a political statement about the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, or TABOR, which was defeated by voters on November 7th. Police said that at least one person who saw the sign thought that it said Taliban.
President Bush is seeking to reassure nervous Asian allies that the United States will remain a reliable partner in liberalizing trade, confronting North Korea's nuclear threat, and fighting terrorism after an election upheaval back home. In Bush's first overseas trip since Republicans lost the House and Senate, world leaders are looking for any sign of change since the election repudiation of his Iraq policy. In an early embarrassment for Bush, the House failed to approve normalized trade relations with Vietnam, a move Bush wanted completed this week. Instead, Congress probably will consider it in December. Bush's eight-day journey takes him to Singapore, Vietnam, and Indonesia. A week later, he will be in Europe for a summit of NATO leaders. The two trips will take him away from Washington at a crucial time when the post-election lame-duck Congress is dealing with issues the White House has deemed vital. The president planned to outline the themes of his trip with a speech in Singapore today, emphasizing how the United States and Asian nations can work together.
The World Bank said yesterday that China must make greater efforts to encourage consumer spending. The World Bank says that the hope is that this will rein back China's surging trade surplus before it creates dire consequences for the local environment. The Development Bank also warned the country's export-led but would cause imbalances in the economy. To keep up growth averaging 10%, Chinese leaders depended on an unsustainable increase in manufacturing output. Rising labor costs and increases in the price of raw materials mean Chinese companies were spending more to create the same output than rival countries such as India. The bank said that attempts by the government to squeeze investment growth were helping the situation, but needed to be matched by growth in consumer spending. This, according to The Guardian.
In a thinly veiled attack on the U.S. and Australia, the U.N. Secretary General, Kofi Annan, said today that a frightening lack of leadership was hindering the fight against global warming. Speaking at the start of the main session of the UN Climate Change Conference in Nairobi, Mr. Annan described the buildup of heat-trapping greenhouse gases that are raising the planet's temperature as an all-encompassing threat to the world. He said the Kyoto Protocol, under which industrialized countries agreed to limit their harmful emissions to pre-1990 levels by 2012, was a key step in tackling the problem. The U.S. and Australia refused to sign the protocol, claiming it would unfairly hurt their economies as it does not commit developing nations, such as China and India, to binding targets. This, according to The Guardian.
In Britain, the government will introduce the long-awaited climate change bill during the coming sessions of Parliament. The Queen announced in the House of Lords that the bill will make up part of the government's policy to protect the environment consistent with the need to secure long-term energy supplies. The climate change legislation will comprise four key elements. It's going to set out a statutory commitment to reduce carbon dioxide emissions from 1990 levels by the year 2050. It'll also establish an independent body, the Carbon Committee, to work with government to reduce emissions over time and across the economy. And it will create enabling powers to put in place new emissions reduction measures needed to achieve set goals. The final phase of the plan will be to improve the monitoring and reporting arrangements, including how the government reports to Parliament. This is another story from The Guardian.
Anti-Castro Cuban dissidents who were given millions of dollars by the U.S. government to support democracy in their homeland instead blew money on computer games, cashmere sweaters, crab meat, and expensive chocolates, which were then sent to the island. A scathing congressional audit of democracy assistance programs found questionable expenditures by several groups funded by Washington in opposition to President Fidel Castro's rule on the communist Caribbean island. The Miami-based Acción Democrática Cubana spent money on a chainsaw, Nintendo Game Boys and Sony PlayStations, mountain bikes, leather coats, and Godiva chocolates, which the group say were all sent to Cuba. Juan Carlos Acosta, the group's executive director, defended the purchase of a chainsaw. He said he needed to cut a tree that had blocked access to his office in a hurricane, and said that the leather jackets and cashmere sweaters were bought in a sale. The audit analyzed $65 million spent by the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, from 1999 to 2005, and concluded that poor management was to blame for the waste. The U.S. government has previously accused the Cuban government of hijacking consignments sent to its Havana mission. This, according to The Guardian.
In Mexico, opposition leader Andrés Manuel López Obrador has assured his followers that by November 20th, some of the most important issues that Mexico faces, including the Oaxaca conflict, will be solved. November 20th is, of course, a significant date in Mexican history. López Obrador stressed that on that day, when his symbolic inauguration will take place, the resistance will tackle the suffering in Oaxaca and the results of keeping an unpopular government in place. He said he'll also tackle ways to impede the transfer of powers to Felipe Calderón. Speaking at a rally to support the southern state and its social movement, López Obrador noted that his legitimate government will protect and defend most of the Mexican people. This from Prensa Latina.
In Nicaragua, all 100% of the votes counted have been confirmed, and the election of Sandinista Daniel Ortega has been certified. The Supreme Electoral Council's CSC results show that Ortega finally obtained 37.99% of valid votes, with 9 points over his closest adversary. This from Prensa Latina.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, November 16th, 2006. Thanks for listening, and thank you for becoming a member of KBOO. You make all the difference. If you've not become a card-carrying member yet, well, it's never too late to have a happy membership.
Today's editor is Chris Andre. Our engineer is Kathleen Stevenson. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director, and I'm Steve Bawau.
I'm Chris Andre. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264 AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220 HR.
Portland area weather, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. Highs 50 to 55. Tonight, mostly cloudy. Again, chance of showers. Lows in the 40s.
You know, we really do need you to help in the AM newsroom. It's fun. It's exciting. You'd be part of the whole SIT crew here in the morning. And to make that commitment to helping out put the news on the air, pick up the phone now and call Kathleen Stevenson. Well, in a few minutes when she gets back to her office, actually. That's 503-231-8032, extension 202. Or you could email her at amnews@kboo.org.
Coming up this morning on member-generated radio station KBOO, Hot 90.7 FM. At 7:30, Joanne Bowman and Dave Mazza, welcome back, Dave, host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Their guest is Portland City Commissioner Randy Leonard. Topics include the PDC, the upcoming city council resolution calling on the president and Congress to authorize withdrawal from Iraq, and Commissioner Leonard's biodiesel ordinance.
At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell.
And at 9:30, Per Fagering interviews John Ross, writer and journalist living in Mexico.
At 10, it's DIY Portland with host Julie Sabatier. This month, the show goes technical and explores the world of open source software with guests from Free Geek, other local organizations working to provide alternatives to the world of Microsoft.
And at 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard speaks with members of the Northwest Print Council, Barbara Mason and Stephen Leflar. And at 11, it's Democracy Now!
Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Community calendar for Thursday, November 16th. Specialty foods, produce, holiday home decor, and just about everything else for the holiday table will be abound at the November 18th Harvest Market, the final Beaverton Farmers Market of the 2006 season. The 8 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. market will bring growers and vendors from around the region with truckloads of supplies. The market is located at the Beaverton City Library parking lot on Southwest Hall Boulevard between 3rd and 5th Streets. Get holiday recipes, ideas for gift giving and special meal preparation with freshly harvested vegetables, fruits, artisan foods, and live music. By many estimates, Beaverton Farmers Market has grown to become the largest all-agricultural farmers market in the Northwest. The market has disabled and senior parking. For information, call 503-643-5345. That's 503-643-5345 or visit the web at beavertonfarmersmarket.com. The Community Warehouse is in desperate need of usable blankets. They can be dropped off at 2267 North Interstate in Portland anytime between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. on weekdays and on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. All items are tax deductible. Community Warehouse is a volunteer-based nonprofit agency in Portland that provides furniture and household items to people in need at no cost to them. Their goal is to help low-income individuals and families improve their quality of life by providing the basic items needed to set up a home. Community Warehouse works in partnership with over 65 social service agencies. These agencies screen and refer those clients in need of basic household items. Clients include women escaping domestic violence, individuals and families who've been homeless, elderly persons, people with mental and physical disabilities, migrant and refugee families, youth and adults recovering from substance abuse, and the working poor. Call 503-235-8786. That's 503-235-8786 for more information or visit the web at communitywarehouse.org. Mayor Tom Potter will be meeting with residents in the Selwood Moreland and surrounding neighborhoods this Saturday, November 18th, from 10 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. at the Smile Station, that's the Old Selwood Firehouse, 8210 Southeast 13th Avenue in Portland. His goal is to connect with residents from different parts of the city about local community issues and ideas. A priority of Mayor Potter's administration is to be accessible to neighborhoods and to develop relationships among community members and local government. Community members are encouraged to sign up on-site for a chance to speak for 10 minutes with him about important issues to them. Local area businesses will be hosting the meetings. Sign-ups begin at 9:30 a.m. Available slots fill up quickly, so please plan accordingly. Mayor Potter will be accompanied by staff, neighborhood police officers, and local community members to provide informational resources. For more information, visit the web at portlandonline.com/mayor. This has been the Community Calendar for Thursday, November 16th. I'm Alicia Olson for KBOO, listener-sponsored, volunteer-powered, non-corporate, commercial-free radio in Portland, Hood River, and Corvallis.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for a full-time evening news and public affairs director. We're looking for someone with news and public affairs skills, writing, editing, production, and training experience in working with volunteers. The job requires the ability to work under deadlines, to work under pressure, and to work evening hours. The ability to work with a wide variety of people in a multicultural and cooperative environment is essential. For more information and to get a job application, please contact Chris Merrick, care of News Director Hiring Committee at KABU, or go online at www.kboo.fm for an online job description. KABU is an equal employment opportunity employer. Deadline is Friday, November the 17th at 5 p.m.
Good morning. This is Joanne Bowman.
And this is Dave Mazza.
Hey, we got Dave Mazza back in the studio, and
Thank you. We are thrilled to have him back. Feels good to be back.
And he's looking good, too. Gosh, you guys should come down and say hi to him, because he's looking really good, and it's wonderful to have him here. We're going to have City Commissioner Randy Leonard on. I'm assuming he's running a little bit late. You know how commissioners are. I'm sure that something got him just tied up a little bit this morning, but we know he's going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
But before he gets here, we're kind of open to talk about other stuff. We had a whole list of stuff we're going to talk to the commissioner about. And if you want to give us a call at 503-231-8187. One of the things that we were talking about is just continues to be new witnesses coming up or talking about what happened in Mr. Chasey's case. And I understand that Willamette Week yesterday did
right.
a piece that talked about some additional witnesses.
Right. Well, I think the disturbing part of the Willamette Week story was that they got a hold of, I think it was 9 witness statements that had been available to the police and clearly contradict the, quote, official fact sheet
right.
that they put out, about a month ago,
right.
in which none of these witnesses seem to agree with Officer Humphreys' version that there was no physical tackling of Mr. Chasey. So, you know, there's kind of a gap here as to what the detectives determined was the real cause of Mr. Chasey's death
right.
and the way these individuals saw it come down.
Hmm.
I think what's interesting, too, is there were a number of these 9 individuals. They saw it from different perspectives.
Right, different angles. Locations.
Right, so it seemed to present a fairly clear picture of what was happening down there.
Right. Wow, that is interesting. Do you know if those 9 individuals actually came in front of the grand jury?
I don't. I'm under the impression that they were, but and the story, as I recall it, reading it yesterday, all that information was available to the police as they compiled their version and, you know, determining what happened.
Right. Wow. So this continues. I understand that on Friday I believe it's going to be the first meeting of this new mental health task force
right.
that the mayor has put together as a next step in addressing the issue of James Chasey's death in the hands of the police. And so I'm hopeful that that this is going to be a successful effort, that this is going to be an effort. I mean, clearly the mayor stepped up and dedicated some money to make sure that all police officers have training in how to interact with people that appear to have mental illness.
Right, right.
But I mean, I think that there's this bigger kind of cultural issue that I would hope the police bureau would address is, anytime somebody doesn't do exactly what they're told, the assumption is that they don't want to do it, as compared to them not having the physical capacity to do what they've been ordered to do. And so I think all of that is part of retraining our police force so that they...
Wow.
So that they are well prepared to really be public servants.
Exactly.
and community police officers, you know.
I still think, too, there's a real issue in terms of management within the police bureau. I think a lot of the officers go astray because we have some really poor middle management.
Right.
They're not tracking the problem officers enough.
Right.
And there's that, you know, old let's close ranks and protect our own.
Right.
I think we're seeing that with this recent case and the discrepancies mm-hmm. in the testimony and just the ongoing problems. I mean, it's important that the officers receive the mental health training.
Right.
But I think the scrutiny still has to be on the bureau and looking at how they do their business and how they manage their people.
Just their day-to-day business, absolutely. And so I've been informed by Commissioner Randy Leonard that he is not late, that you requested he come at 7:45.
You know, he's right.
And so I so apologize. Okay, folks? Commissioner Leonard is not late. It's just the co-host didn't know.
Okay. And I apologize for not keeping Joanne informed.
Yeah, we don't want the commissioner coming in being mad because I misrepresented him.
And I will say, too, that Commissioner Leonard responded so quickly to my email and agreed to do this. It was a very nice process. So.
Yeah. Well, it's always fun having him on because he's always a man with strong opinions, and I'm looking forward to having that conversation. So I've been out of town most of the week, so I'm like really behind in what's been happening locally. You and I were talking just before the program started. Now that we've had this shift in mm-hmm. the political landscape nationally as well as here locally, now is actually time to get some stuff done, you know?
Exactly.
It's been, we've had years and years and years of hearing, we can't do anything because, you know? Can't do this because, you know? We don't have the legislative votes, we can't do this. So I'm really looking forward to an agenda, and I'm not, you know, I'm not one of those people that assume that because Democrats control all three, both House chambers and the governor's mansion, that we just do everything we've ever wanted to do. I'm not under that illusion. But I do believe that it's important that the Democratic caucus come up with a clear plan about how they're going to correct the myriad of problems we have in this state. I mean, I know one of the big issues on the agenda is opening these mental health hospitals all around the state.
Right.
The last legislative session approved that, but this legislative session has to make sure that it's on track. It has the money that it needs to actually start building these clinics all across the state. You know, it for me, one of the big issues that I've been working on is really thinking about how do we in Oregon create a universal health care system.
Exactly.
So if we're creating mental health centers across the state, we should be thinking about how do we ultimately turn those into full-service health clinics for everyone.
Right, because obviously, you know, the situation is becoming so untenable. Businesses cannot afford to provide the coverage.
Right.
More and more people are falling off the edge of the table there, and now's the opportunity. Of course, that also means the legislature's going to have to look at how we get revenue in.
That's right.
And look at the tax issue.
Right.
Get some tax equity back here.
Exactly. And something I'm certainly looking forward to advocating for. And, you know, the beer and wine tax, you know, let's not pretend that that's not on the table, because mm-hmm. that absolutely has to be raised. It's been way, 20, 25 years?
Something like that
is absolutely insulting. So talk about, now how do you pay for mental health treatment and alcohol and drug treatment? You've got a revenue source right there. And
right.
even if you doubled what the tax is now, it's not so overwhelming that people will all of a sudden stop buying beer and wine.
No. Well, it's proven with cigarettes.
Exactly. Huh? Right. That's been definitely proven with cigarettes. well, that's another story. Do we have a caller there? Yes, we do. Good morning, caller. Welcome to Cable.
Hello. You know, I feel like the kid that's seeing the emperor with no clothes on, or should I say the old lady seeing the emperor with no clothes on. When people analyze and talk about these police brutality incidents with mentally ill people, what people don't seem to see or get is that what the police are doing to the mentally ill person or other people is mentally ill.
Boy, nothing like short, succinct comments. And thank you, caller. Appreciate your call this morning. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I'm Joanne Bowman. And
I'm Dave Mazza.
And isn't it wonderful to be able to hear that? Dave Mazza. Okay, clearly, the next legislative session, we've got some excitement around that. When Commissioner Leonard comes in, I certainly want to find out more about the biodiesel and how the legislative movement could actually help him in his efforts at the city of Portland. Because I know Representative Jacqueline Dingfelder had a bill that she tried to get through the last legislative session that failed.
Didn't go anywhere, right. And hopefully that's not going to be such a problem with the change in the Speaker of the House.
Well, yeah, having Jeff Merkley as speaker is going to be pretty awesome, I believe. And I believe, you know, and I'm hopeful. I mean, what I've been sensing locally as well as nationally, I don't see people gloating. I don't see people, you know, trying to be outrageous with what they're proposing for the next legislative agenda. But I see people really trying to be very thoughtful and I have to say a little cautious, right? Because, you know, 2 years is not that long away and people are very aware that the public is paying attention. So I guess that's the good news is that the public is paying attention.
I think too, there's probably been a lot of, private sighs of relief from moderate Republicans who now see a chance to do some of the things they've been wanting to do, but having to put on hold because of the extreme right wing of their party.
That's right.
Sort of nipping all that in the bud.
That's true.
And that means we, you know, we have a chance to really do some constructive things now.
And, but, you know, I've always told people, and I think people get surprised by that, there are some folks that will believe, well, now that Democrats control everything, there's no more advocacy that needs to happen. The world's going to be wonderful and, you know, and I want to dispel that myth because, you know, it's just as important. I would say even more so now that we've got the ability to pass really good legislation to hold, their feet to the fire to make sure that they're doing good things for most Oregonians. I was going to get the phone, but, I think Richard went to get our guest. So we'll just, the phone will have to wait just a minute or two until I come. So now I can really say he's late. He's 2 minutes and 19 seconds. Good morning, Commish. How are you today?
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So now I can officially say you're late. You're 2 minutes and 19 seconds late.
Now I'm legitimately late.
Welcome.
I was falsely accused.
I had to laugh. Did you hear me laugh when I read that? Okay. I stand corrected.
And what's this about? I have strong opinions. I can't get a word in edgewise when I'm around you. What are you talking about?
Oh, not me, not me. You've got me. You're misunderstood.
Yeah, I am.
We got a caller, so let me take the caller and give you a chance to catch your breath a little bit. All right? Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Boo.
Well, hi, Joanne. How are you?
I'm fabulous. How about you?
I am so groovy. Thank you very, very much.
Groovy? You got to be of my generation.
Mr. Mazda, I really want to welcome you back.
Thank you.
It's so wonderful to hear your voice again. And I want you to know that Joanne did a good job in your absence.
I enjoyed listening to her, and as always, she was on top form.
Yeah. Okay, so my comments this morning will be really brief. I know Mr. Leonard has a connection with the police bureau, and I don't want to sound like I'm prejudiced, but life in the cop shop is business as usual. The police have a tendency to protect each other, being they are a mutually exclusive group. I got to be honest up front, the police department are not exactly my favorite cultural group because they tend to isolate themselves from the rest of the community, especially in social situations. Mm. Police hang out with police, blah, blah, blah. All right. So I tend never to believe the official story because I think the official story is just a story. So, that being said, have a great show.
Thank you. Appreciate the call today.
Bye-bye.
Take care. I was waiting for the facts. Yeah. Because he's always, this particular caller always calls in and gives me a whole bunch of facts that blow me away. But you could tell that he really feels what he's saying this morning.
Yeah. I mean, I do have talked to the police bureau about doing more training, as we did up at the Bureau of Development Services with our permit people, the people that issue building permits. Because I do think that they could benefit from training. And what we call it up there, and I don't know that we'd have to call it any different, is customer service training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basic things, how you treat people, how you address people, that makes a big difference in any interaction that a person has with anybody from the city, but particularly a police officer, are just the basic, polite interactions when you meet somebody. And I do think they could, some of them could use some help with that.
I was just going to say, that was one of the things that we heard over and over and over again with the community listening sessions is it's so easy to just say thank you, yes sir, no sir, yes ma'am, no
easy
ma'am.
Easy and important.
Easy and important. And, we heard people say over and over and over again how the dialogue, how the conversation was just so harsh and nasty. And regardless of, even if you're arresting a murderer, there's absolutely no reason to be disrespectful and harsh. I mean, if you've been trained appropriately, you should be able to treat everybody like you would treat somebody's grandmother.
Well, the caller said that I had a connection with the police bureau, and that connection is I was a firefighter for 25 years.
Right.
And oftentimes, that's where the similarity stops, because I will tell you, in the fire bureau, the culture is such that if you interact with the public at any level for any reason in a rude or abrasive manner, we fire people in the fire bureau for that offense. Mm-hmm. So as a result, the standards in the fire bureau for community relationships are high, and it's reflected in the auditor's annual report. There is no bureau that approaches the fire bureau in customer approval from the Portland citizens year after year. I mean, I'm talking in the 90 percentile range consistently for the last 20 years since that survey has been done. And I learned a lesson from that when I came to the city, and that is other city employees could benefit from that same kind of culture and that same kind of expectation and training. And that's what we do require that of the employees that I am responsible for at the Bureau of Development Services, the Water Bureau, and the 911 Center.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to say I have a number of acquaintances who are police officers with other cities, and when they've come and worked with the Portland police, they've told horror stories. They've just been really shocked at the way a lot of the officers interact with the citizens, which tells me something's really out of sync. But the other thing I wanted to ask you was, I have this sense that we have a real middle management problem in the Bureau, that the problem officers aren't being tracked the way they should be tracked, and they go way off the rails before you can kind of reform them. And the officers who are trying to do a good thing aren't getting the positive strokes. Do you have any sort of feel for...
Well, I'll tell you, in any organization where there are problems, I don't try to find out at what level you hold somebody accountable. In my view, you always hold the person at top the accountable. If somebody screws up in the Water Bureau or the Bureau of Development Service, the 911 Center, I get the phone call, and appropriately so, and ask, first of all, how did this problem happen and what am I going to do about it? I have the same level expectation of the police bureau. And I think the chief and the mayor are responsible ultimately for everything that happens under their command. And they certainly deservedly get the credit when good things happen, but along with that comes responsibility for things that don't go so well. And we have a level of expectation of the employees that I have responsibility for that I have developed as reflects my experience in the fire bureau. And I will tell you that it is different than how I view the police bureau being run. And I think that it matters how you treat people. And I honestly don't know that all organizations in the city have that concept as part of their mission. It matters how you treat people. I mean, just a simple hello, good morning, courtesies go a long way to diffuse situations.
Absolutely true. We got a few callers on the line, so let's go to the phone line. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two issues I'd like to address. One of them is having to do with the benzene and the pollution related to gasoline.
Right.
Okay.
In our area.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I learned that we get our gasoline from just three refineries in Washington.
Right.
And I wonder what the what Randy Leonard's thoughts would be on maybe trying to lead the city to buy the fuel from the BP refinery that actually has the California standard gasoline, as opposed to the other two refineries which are spewing the pollution into the air.
I hadn't thought of that as a choice. I am focused on the benzene issue, excuse me, as a lot of us are since the Oregonian article a couple weeks ago in the Sunday Oregonian. In fact, I'm developing a resolution that I hope to introduce in the next couple of weeks that will call on Congress to pass standards that mandate that the benzene levels be no higher in Oregon gasoline than it is in California gasoline. Unfortunately, we cannot pass that ourselves because we're preempted by federal law from doing so. So our resolution that we'll be sending to Congress will be a request for our congressional delegation, which hopefully will be led by Congressman Blumenauer. I know Senator Wyden is already focused on this. He has issued a statement holding up one of the EPA nominees until these benzene levels are reduced in the gasoline in Oregon. Your suggestion of using BP gas, I will go, when I go back to City Hall, I will ask about that.
And for people that are shopping for gasoline, that's the ARCO stations,
mm-hmm.
have the California standards of gasoline is what my research from the BP Cherry Point refinery. There's only three refineries that we get our gasoline from, so that seems to be the weak link.
Yeah.
Excellent. What's your other issue?
The other issue has to do with the police bureau, what we're talking about. And I'm wondering if tasers are so wonderful and they seem to be widespread within the police bureau now. Every officer seems to have one as well as their gun. I'm wondering why not take away the gun rights for people that are out on their beat, and give them to a select few people that have had linguistics training that can be on a rapid response team, and let the officers rely on their linguistics and their tasers until we figure out how to re-educate ourselves and act a little bit more accordingly with maybe what some other Canadian or European countries do, which is with respect towards their citizens. Mm. And that way when we need, you know, heavy weapons or guns, we can call in a special response team that is more highly trained to deal with some of these very, you know, potentially dangerous situations.
Well, I'm meeting with the mayor today. I'll pass that along to him. That's
well,
an excellent
I appreciate
suggestion.
That.
Thank you. You know, the one thing I want to add to that is I actually went to the police bureau. I had a strategic planning process that was for community and police officers to come together and help them develop, I was going to say a 2-year plan, but the reality is a 1-year plan because it's actually for 06 and 07. So by the time everything is said and done, it's really a plan for next year. And one of the interesting suggestions that came out of that was, I can't remember, it's in California. One of the police departments in California requires that at any incident where police are called out to, if there appears to be a need to escalate use of force, then they are required to have a sergeant on site prior to them making the decision to escalate the use of force. And the person who presented that at that strategic planning said that in this particular community, deaths in custody, people being shot in custody, all were significantly reduced, and I'm talking like over 50% over a short period of couple of years after they implemented this new law.
Right.
And I thought that was, you know, that was just kind of phenomenal.
That
to
also
think.
Sounds like it would address Dave Monza's suggestion of where's the oversight
mm-hmm.
for, you know, sounds
right.
like that would provide the oversight for maybe the officers that are perpetuating the problem within the Bureau.
That, yeah, it does sound like that's like, it makes perfect sense, because as you started, when you sat down, you said, you know, who's responsible is the person at the top that's responsible. So having leaders there, having people who are responsible for managing police officers, they're helping them make appropriate decisions, may be a very good thing. So I'm hopeful that out of all the ideas that came up through that one-day training or that one-day planning process, that's an idea that Chief Sizer will move forward.
But, of course, with my background, I'm very aware that sometimes you're required to make decisions instantly.
Oh, snap judgment.
And there are circumstances which that is just not going to be possible to call somebody.
Sure.
So I get back to training and what your expectations are of each individual officer. I think that's I think it's not only realistic, it is something that we can do a better job of with the Portland Police, and that is how we interact with the new officers, how we communicate to them our expectation level, that, you know, police officers do socialize at times exclusively with each other. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but if you are being trained to think that everybody's against you and you have to stick together, that's I think
that creates a
problem.
Mindset.
And I do think that we can do a better job in training, and I say that based on my own experience working with new firefighters and just kind of how we communicated to them, what we said to them, what we expected of them, and the action we took against those that didn't rise to the level scared the other ones that remained after we fired.
Right.
And they got it. They're like, hey, you know, I need this job.
Right. That's a good message, right? Because if the people are gone who aren't following the rules, then that says that
you're Pretty strong message.
Yeah. By the way, you're listening to KBOO Portland. Thank you, caller. Appreciate you calling in this morning.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Have a great day. 503-231-8187. The lines are just lighting up this morning.
All right. Well,
I tell you, bring a city commissioner on, and all of a sudden people want to talk.
I was going to say, as long as we're talking about public, you know, interactions with the public, I hope we have a chance to talk a little bit about your trying to adjust the attitude of the Portland Development Commission.
Oh, yeah.
There's been some stories in the paper recently about what seems to be kind of a rift between the council and the commission. And it seems that I know some of the comments you've made certainly reflect concerns out here in the city that the commission is out of touch with where Portlanders want to see their city go and in the way they do their business as well.
Right.
Could you perhaps bring our listeners a little up to speed on what the current situation is?
Well, you know, interestingly, it isn't such a stark transition from talking about the culture at the Portland Police Bureau to the PDC. I mean, honestly, it's much the same kind of issue I've discovered, and that is the culture within the organization. And I'm not talking about the appointed commissioners, the commissioners that are the five-member commission that's appointed and then confirmed by the council, or even that much, I'm not talking about the executive director, who is a fairly new person in that position. But what I've learned in the 4 years now I've been on the council, and, of course, having lived here all my life and the observations I've had of the PDC, is it not only acts separate from the city, it thinks separate from the city.
Right.
And sometimes that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, sometimes you have to make tough decisions that that are politically unpopular. I understand that. But that's not what my criticism is. For an example, in the budget, as Joanne will tell you, the one of the most fundamental responsibilities of a democratic form of government is to have elected officials review and approve a budget. Sounds kind of boring. Sorry about that. One of your callers is trying to circumvent the call in here.
Trying to slip
that.
In, yeah.
Yeah.
They're an ingenious group, aren't they?
They are, by the way. Go directly through the caller here. They have, with respect to their budget, resisted, fought, refused to comply with the council's request. And I will say a majority of the council versus the council.
Right.
There's a difference. A majority of the councils request, if not demand, that they present their budget to us in a line item form so we can look at it. Mm-hmm. And yes, we want to look at things like their travel budget. We want to look at things like decisions they make to buy property. I mean, are they paying more than what they should? In some cases, for instance, at this Third Noak, Southwest Third Noak deal that you may have read about, where the PDC acquired the property for $850,000, spent $500,000 improving it, so they're up to $1.35 million. And then somehow they had an appraisal come in to say it was worth negative $2.7 million, and based on that, thought they were doing a heck of a deal by just giving it to a developer. Mm-hmm. Well, frankly, that kind of a deal reeks.
Smells.
Yeah. And I called for an audit and passed that on a 3-2 vote at the council. That showed preliminarily that that it wasn't accurate to say it was worth negative 2.7. It was in fact worth $1.83 million. And then the audit, the preliminary results also showed that the PDC was refusing to turn over certain information that the audit requested to comply with the council's resolution. That led to me filing a resolution that was on the calendar yesterday that would actually have done this unprecedented thing of having the city subpoena from itself documents and emails.
Does that mean it didn't pass?
Well, I put it on hold yesterday, primarily because the PDC has indicated that now they intend to fully comply. Mm-hmm. So I put it on hold in that I postponed the hearing for 2 weeks, anticipating that they are going to come in with all the documents we requested.
Wonderful.
So do we need to restructure the PDC or make it just a bureau?
Yeah, well, I actually had a resolution I introduced a year ago that there was a hearing on in front of City Council that would have eliminated the commission itself, not the bureau, not the bureaucracy, not the director, their mission or any of that, but the elected body, and made the council, this resolution, would have gone to the voters, and the voters would have voted to amend the charter to make the City Council the development commission, as is the case, by the way, in every other city in Portland, or Oregon. Every other city in Oregon has a development commission as Portland does, but they don't have a separate development commission. Their city councils hit a gavel and turn into the development commission and do the same kind. They have urban renewal areas and all that. The difference is that the elected officials make the decision. The elected officials approve the budgets. Okay. The elected officials hold the bureaucracy accountable. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in my view, I've come to the conclusion that the bureaucracy of the PDC is not accountable to anyone. And pretty much run the way they want to run. And I think there's three of us on this city council that have identified that, recognize that, and have committed, I might add, not without a whole lot of political resistance, particularly from the mayor, to do that.
So we're going to go back to the phone line. And I want to come back to PDC because I'm just curious as to whether or not the focus of PDC is the right focus at this time. So I'll come back to that question, but let's get some callers in. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO. Hello? Hello, hello. Good morning, caller. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Speaking of holding those accountable at the top, would not the commissioners of the PDC be held accountable for this?
They are, but
they're not elected. They're appointed.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so who appoints them?
The city council.
The mayor appoints and the council confirms.
Okay. So if we use the same thinking as we do with the police department, that those at the top should be held accountable, then perhaps we need to be a little bit more assertive in that area. But what I was interested in...
Well, let me address that.
I think you are, actually.
I, that's what I was going to say, is I do accept that responsibility,
right,
as you do expect of me, and I think a majority of us get that on the council. We feel responsible and feel a responsibility to change the way the
commission operates. No, I was just responding to what you had said, that the commissioners aren't really the problem, but they are in charge, so...
Correct.
...of the PDC. Not you, but the PDC commissioners. But I wanted to go back to the police department for a minute, and it's really interesting to me how whenever something tragic happens or, you know, people are killed or violently abused, the humanity of the police department is always brought up, how they're humans too and they can make mistakes and they feel fears, and same as any other human being. But then we give them so much authority and power that we wouldn't give any other human being. And I think an individual who is given that authority of power, who isn't well trained, and who doesn't have the common courtesy, which all of us, I believe, most of us have been trained from childhood to have at least common courtesy for our fellow human beings. I don't know what happens when they get into that training, where all of a sudden that goes out the window. But giving them that much authority and power and their word over anyone else's is very intriguing to me, that we allow that to happen. But then when something wrong happens, we divert to the fact that they are human beings and they are vulnerable just like any of the rest of us. So why we give them that much power and let them walk around with those semi-automatic weapons on their hips is a very interesting dynamic that happens. But I have a question for you, and I mentioned this last week, Joanne. Who on the city council has oversight on the chronic nuisance ordinance procedures, policies and procedures?
The as far as drug houses and those kinds of things?
Well, not necessarily drug houses. As I understand it, it can be houses where police or emergency response has been requested more than, I don't know how many.
Right.
There's a letter generated from a sergeant in the police department
right.
to the homeowner saying that because of so many times we've had to respond to this house, they get this chronic nuisance letter and tell them they need to secure their home or else the city is going to.
Damn.
Who has responsibility or oversight of that?
The mayor's office.
Okay.
But I'm very familiar with that ordinance.
Because it's interesting how it combines.
And the mayor's office has responsibility, but I've actually used it in my office because we have the housing inspectors or are sometimes known as the nuisance inspectors. And we've actually utilized that ordinance in my office more than once to get compliance for the kind of places you're talking about.
Right. What is interesting to me is the only ones that I'm aware of have been elderly citizens who've lived in the community for a long time, years and years and years and years, who have large extended families. And sometimes the requests for the police to come are calls from new neighbors who see too many young men out front playing basketball or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if those are tallied as part of the number of times the police have come.
That I'm not aware of.
And I am concerned that there's no oversight and there's no, it's all very
subjective
and arbitrary on when this occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if anyone's kept track of that or if there's any information that one could gather to see how many homes have been affected, homeowners who live in the homes.
If I could elaborate just a bit, I think the big issue that this caller is referring to is just certainly this perception in Northeast Portland that new people move into the neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
they don't know the community norms,
mm-hmm.
and they call the police on a regular basis. And I certainly know that when Foxworth was leading the Northeast Precinct, I had had this conversation with him, and he says it's really a catch-22 because, of course, when a call comes in, the police are required to respond.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the reality is if people haven't met their neighbors,
mm-hmm.
they don't know that the kids that they think are gang members are actually the ones that live on their block, right? They don't know that this is a normal meeting place of young people
right.
when they get out of school. It creates this perception that somehow the house is a nuisance house because they get the call all the time.
Right.
You know, I got gang members casing my house. You know, you need to get out here. And so it has a lot of unintended consequences when
mm-hmm.
those calls come in. One may be that senior homeowners are losing their homes through no fault of their own
mm-hmm.
and through a lack of knowledge.
It seems like there's a process that happens. And what's interesting to me is a lot of these citizens, elderly citizens, prior to these occurrences, are approached constantly.
To sell their home.
They want to buy their house.
Right.
They want to sell their house. They want to sell their house.
So let's
and
give
all
them
of a sudden, they don't want to sell their house.
Let's give
That's
them a
their
chance.
Family home.
Let's give them a chance to respond, and then we're going to have to move on. Thanks.
There hasn't been a case since I've been on the council because the chronic nuisance ordinance actually has to go through and being approved by the council because you're actually taking somebody's house because of chronicness. I don't think one has happened since I've been on the council. There are, I mean, in the nuisance field, we oftentimes use our nuisance laws in the city through the inspectors that I have responsibility for to get houses cleaned up, and sometimes they are occupied by elderly people. One of the things I've tried to do different is to change the mentality of them from fining and leaning the property, which could cause an elderly person to have to sell, to actually getting the problem fixed. So for an example, when I first got on the council, an actual example was of an elderly woman in a house who had a gutter that was disconnected and laying on the ground, hanging from the house, laying on the ground. She, by the time I got on the council, she had acquired $10,000 in fines and liens on her property, and her gutter was still disconnected. Wow. So I asked what I thought was a pretty simple question is, why don't you just have the gutter fixed and lien the property for the $150 that it would have cost to fix the gutter? And then
why not use some of that money for tax abatements and everything to fix it for her and not put a lien on her house?
So that is exactly the direction we have begun to take, is to get people in the city to, when they identify problems, as opposed to citing, particularly an elderly or disabled person, citing them, get somebody out to fix it, and then if they can't pay for it, lien the property for the cost of the repair.
Thank you for your call.
Is there anywhere one could look to
find out
about this information, where to look to find out how many homes, the ones that have been boarded
up?
Call the auditor's office or go online and look. He tracks all that. Gary Blackmer, the city auditor.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
Thanks. I feel welcome. And welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
Wow, it's so good to hear you. And welcome to the commissioner, to our radio station. Joanne, it's Jeff in North Portland. There's one profound thing that I've just discovered, but I also wanted to leapfrog a bit and ask the commissioner about energy, fuels, and all that. But the profundity, if that's a word, that I've discovered is this, and it just thunderstruck me. There is no such thing as a toy gun. Now, you think about it. How many times, like the fellow over in Vancouver that was shot by the police over there who had a gun, a toy gun, so forth and so on, and how many times do we teach our boys especially to run around and we go and buy them the guns at the Walmarts and the Targets and the Kmarts? Then we arm our children with toy guns, but a gun, by its nature, is not a toy, thereby I think we can safely say that there is no such thing as a toy gun. That's the profundity. I was wondering, Commissioner, how we're going to move forward now with new fuels, not just for our fleets in this city, but first of all, that benzene suggestion from a previous brother that called is brilliant, and I think you really need to get on that. I'm sure you're aware of that. But how we're going to change how we drive around right here in this town, how we use fuel? Are we going to go to Eastern Oregon? Are we going to get the biofuels? And are we going to lead? Is this city going to lead in such a way as it should, as always has, as the lovely feel-good liberal city that it is? Are we going to lead on the hydrogen economy that's been so ballyhooed of late? Those are my questions. Thanks, Joanne.
Thank you. Welcome back, Dave. I love you guys.
Bye.
Have a great day.
As far as the alternative fuels go, I introduced last summer, and it was adopted unanimously by the council, a mandate that July 1st, 2007, all diesel sold in the city of Portland has 10% biodiesel. All gasoline, or excuse me, 5% biodiesel. All diesel sold in Portland is 5% biodiesel. All gasoline sold in Portland must be 10% ethanol. Both of those additions dramatically reduce greenhouse gases. Ethanol and biodiesel have a much better impact on the environment than do petroleum-based products. I have gone to Eastern Oregon and met with the farmers back there about growing the crops that we would end up using here as the source for the biodiesel and ethanol, for that matter. They are very excited about partnering with the city. In fact, the mayor of Pendleton was in town last night, and Mayor Potter and I had dinner with him to further the conversation. We're not just doing these feel-good, we'd like to help you, you'd like to help us. We're actually trying to do a deal with the Pendleton Grain Growers Association, of which the mayor of Pendleton, Phil Houck, has been very instrumental in working with us on. And it's done a few things. As Joanne remembers from her legislature days, there has been this kind of rift between Eastern Oregon folks and those of us in the Valley. And I've long advocated the best way to heal the urban-rural split is with cold, hard cash. and that just seems to make a lot of people feel better about a lot of things if you're talking about giving them money.
That's right.
And so we are talking about just that, them growing a crop that we buy a lot of, and they're excited when we are. And I think it's Portland is the only city in the United States that has this mandate.
Excellent. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to K-Boot.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome.
Hi. There's a position I think maybe, Randy, you could take on alternate fuels and automotive technologies you discussing this morning. And I'm convinced that the automotive technology we should be advancing right now for all of our cars, so many of them, if not all, and our fleet vehicles, like our buses, you know, TriMet's buses, mm-hmm. is the hybrid technology. And I say there's a dozen reasons why this technology is not just totally practical and doable right away, but it's a better technology even than hydrogen. I'm a skeptic of hydrogen. I'd like to see, I think we've been testing those two hybrid buses we've been running around for the last 2 years long enough, and we should take a stand on adding more of them.
Well, I agree with you that hybrid technology is a significant part of the solution of energy independence and cleaning up the environment. I have been within the hybrid technology disagreeing with some who have focused on hybrid in gasoline engines. I think we ought to be focusing on hybrid diesel engines.
Any fuel that you can use is applicable in a hybrid. What you've got is available. It will work.
But the difference is when you use diesel technology in a hybrid, you get upwards of 70 to 100 miles a gallon versus gasoline hybrid technology, which gets about 45 or 50 miles a gallon.
And then the advanced hybrid is the one where you add batteries and reduce the size of the engine.
Right.
The hybrid is really the way to go, and I hope you will add it to a significant part of your portfolio.
There aren't a lot of, to be honest with you, I think for a lot of reasons hybrid gasoline engines do not make sense. I think hybrid diesel technology makes a lot of sense, and the moment we can acquire them for our fleet, that's my intention.
And I would disagree. I'd say any fuel. In fact, you could burn hydrogen.
Well, I would tell you, I mean, we don't want to take the whole hour with this, but I will tell you that right now today, a Jetta diesel, Volkswagen Jetta diesel, burning 100% biodiesel, a crop made here in Oregon, gets about the same miles a gallon than the hybrid Prius that the mayor drives. Mm-hmm. And it has a whole lot better impact on the environment when you compare them side by side. And the Jetta is cheaper, so working people can afford it. And the Jetta requires very little maintenance. They don't have spark plugs. They don't have a fleet of batteries underneath them that cost $3,000 or $4,000 when they go out to replace. So I will respectfully disagree with you on the gasoline hybrid part.
I respectfully disagree too, and continue. I say that the plug-in hybrid is the way to go, and that's the way we lead towards. So that works on any fuel, including
that's true.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. I love it when two very intelligent people are debating the future of how we're going to make sure that we actually are using energy wisely and efficiently and taking advantage of the best technology around.
And I think the oil companies and President Bush have done us a tremendous favor in this regard. Because honestly, without them cranking up the price of fuel, people were just fat and happy driving the way they were. And this has allowed people to really understand that this is an issue. And it's something I think you and I have talked about before, Joanne. But years ago, I said at a public debate when I was running for the council, when I was asked what one thing I would do to help get us off our dependence on foreign oil, I said, right, I'd raise the price of gas to $5 a gallon, mm-hmm, and have the tax that it be by a tax, and that go into funds to develop alternate technology and alternate, mm-hmm, means to fuel our vehicles. Right. And the oil companies did it for us. Unfortunately, right, we didn't get the benefit of the funds to do the research ourselves, but it did inspire people to look at other ways to fuel vehicles.
Absolutely true. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good. You're kind of all over the map this morning. it's actually pretty good. Take a couple little quick things here. Hydrogen's kind of, from what I understand, the joke. The hydrogen cell is $15,000 for a little cell that only lasts 300 miles. Right. So if you got $15,000 every 300 miles, go ahead with the hydrogen, buddy. You know, that's the way to go.
But so, that's today. I would agree with people who say we need to do more research and develop the technology, because as they make that process more efficient, hydrogen does offer a lot of solutions, but you're right, it's in the future.
Yeah, and you know, we ain't got that much time. I mean, really. So really, we need to look back and go back to electric. Electric has no gas, it has no oil, it has no dirt, it never breaks down. It really lasts a long time. And I don't know why people are so scared to get back on the bandwagon with the electricity. You might be able to, you know, you got cars that drive 200 miles per hour. Where are you going to do that in the United States?
Well,
I think that's all we really have to worry about, is getting up to 55.
One of the issues with electric vehicles, of course, it has to be considered, is you have to get the power from somewhere to charge the batteries.
Right.
And when you plug into a PGE outlet,
right,
you're getting power from a coal-generating plant,
right,
that do significantly impact,
right,
the global warming. So you have to, the power isn't just there.
Yeah.
I mean, it comes from somewhere. I mean, one does have to consider the source of that power.
Right. And we're going to be battling on this for a long time, and that's good. The PDC, I live in Oregon City, and so I'm not really too much on it, but it sounds like to me that there's a bunch of crooks on it, and really the crooks are only the representatives of the people that elected them, and really it's a big bonanza. I mean, we're really dealing with a huge bonanza of transference of funds and land ever since 9/11. And I guess, you know, the same way happened with Pearl Harbor, you still had, it was this doorway to the bonanza for the rich to take land, take money, and transfer it from the poor and the middle class to the wealthy. So I see this as a class war. I see this as a class war. They're some of the line troops. And I really see this as a problem, and we really need to get a handle on this. And the last point I want to make is, I love what that guy said earlier about the police. All those police guys don't deserve guns. I don't think just because they go through a class, they don't have the mental capacity to carry guns. And I think there should be somebody that comes out and says, okay, you know, because they don't start shooting right away all the time. I mean, a lot of times they all come up and they surround the block and they get all their stuff, you know. But there should be somebody that should be on hand with emergency task force to come in and make sure these guys don't take it upon themselves to be righteous. And really, I don't think all of them have the mental capacity to carry guns, and they shouldn't. They're not in the military. If they want to carry guns, they could go to the Army or the National Guard or whatever. So, and the last point is, community needs to educate, and I like what that guy said. We're pre-programming children to become these monsters with these guns. I mean, it's just amazing to see 3- and 4-year-old kids practicing on killing each other at 3 years old. That's a programming. It's an ingrainment into the subconscious of the child, and that's where we need to go and educate the and get these toys off the shelves. Very great show, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 503-231-8187. Any part of that you want to comment on before
I mean, there's a lot there. I would disagree that there are criminal motivations at the PDC. I think that a lot of times, while it may feel criminal to us,
right,
what we see is what actually is happening, again, is kind of a culture, in a very sequestered kind of culture, where they – And but I would agree. I would agree to the extent that he said that there are class issues involved. I have been a person my whole life that has believed, as I've become an adult, that there are real distinction, more clear distinctions in our country between income classes than there are races. So that, in other words, people of various ethnic backgrounds and races have more in common when they are working class people than they do have differences because they might be a different color. And I think one of the hopefully great things that we're seeing happen in the country at large and in Oregon is that recognition that there, that we should be, as a working class group of people, understanding that when PDC makes a lot of the decisions it does, it is for the powerful and the elite. And not allow ourselves to be divided along race lines or even religious lines, because what we have in common is a legitimate desire to have the income that PDC strives to create in our community fairly directed at working class neighborhoods. That includes inner Northeast Portland as well as Lentz. That includes outer Southeast Portland as well as communities like Multnomah. And oftentimes we allow ourselves to be kind of divided into subgroups that make us less powerful. So to that extent, I actually agree with what the caller said.
I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, because I actually think that if you add race on top of poverty, then what you have is a double whammy when you come to trying to improve and engage communities. Even though I think economic issues, there are some threads that call across color lines, I think once you add race to the issue of income, I think that it just creates a double
that's
whammy.
My point. That's right. Actually my point is I don't know how to put this any better than this. People in low income classes who happen to be white that think they have distinctions with people who are black are their own worst enemies.
Ah.
Because the people who are black that share their economic plight in our country are their brothers and sisters in arms. I mean, these are people that share the exact same needs and desires.
Right.
Because the white person that has darkness in their heart goes home at night to the same kind of
conditions
and struggles as an African American does. And unfortunately, there are a number of people of that income class who look like me who don't understand that and allow themselves to be used to think that there's some other issue besides these economic similarities that they share with people of not just that are African American, but Hispanic, Hispanics, Native Americans, Asians. I mean, it's something that I see actually changing. I see in the last election people recognizing that more and more, not allowing themselves to be divided. I mean, the gay marriage issue is of the same nature. It's how do you subdivide this powerful group of economic interests? Well, let's talk about that group that might happen to be a gay or a lesbian and cross divisive lines within there. So then you have people that are gay and lesbian that are working class, finding themselves at war with other working class people because of their sexual orientation.
Right.
I happen to believe that that is a premeditated kind of strategy that the power elite uses. And I think all of us have kind of, especially us here in the audience, that I think agrees with this kind of philosophy, to recognize that and reach out and try to get people to see we share a common economic interest, and there is a class struggle. And it isn't necessarily premeditated, but it exists. When people are raised in some kind of comfort and are used to that, they only relate to people like that, and they don't necessarily relate to working class people and don't understand the struggles and how important it is to get a place that you're proud of, that you own. And have, I mean, we have this fight over skinny houses in neighborhoods.
Right.
For instance, in the neighborhood I grew up in, I find that a little bit elitist, to be honest with you, because I happen to know a lot of very hardworking working class people who see as their dream the ability to buy one of those skinny houses and own their own house.
Right.
There are a lot of people in the neighborhood I grew up in Irvington who now think that that's some kind of an offensive thing to happen, to have a skinny house. Having said that, they need to be designed well and look good, but still, I mean, there are a lot of issues that touch on this class struggle that go beyond just the PDC or or corporate America. That's an issue in our neighborhoods.
That's Yeah.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. So I want to ask my PDC question, and what you've just gave me a great segue into my concern. Right now, it is almost impossible for any new family starting out to be able to own a home, and I would suggest even rent within the city of Portland. And Irvington was one of the communities you talked about, which is the community I live in. And what I know in Irvington, in my block, you can't get a house for less than $700,000. Right. It is absolutely insane. And so what we've created now is a city that working people can't live in. We have a urban renewal organization, the PDC, that is supposedly focused on community development, creating economic opportunities. Is it time to shift PDC from being focused on bringing businesses in from out of state and promising them the moon to get them to move here? Is it time now to have PDC really shift to a focus on affordable housing, making sure that people who work in the city have the ability to own a home, have the ability to live in the city, and not as has happened in Northeast Portland, where people have been pushed out to Gresham, Hillsborough, Troutdale, Vancouver. I mean, it's frightening to see what's happened in the last 5 years. I mean, this is a new phenomena. And so we have one organization that's actually responsible for helping with the economic vitality of the city, and their focus hasn't shifted, even though the new reality of home ownership and who can afford to be in the city has.
Let me give you a little different perspective on that. I grew up on Northeast 8th and Siskiyou, one house from Irving Park. So I was born there in 1952. I left in 1972. What some people correctly view now as gentrification and a lack of affordable housing in the neighborhood I grew up in, people like me that grew up in that neighborhood look at as a safe neighborhood. It was not like that. It was the I've actually had discussions with people who've tried to tell me how rough their neighborhoods and whatnot are. Right. So you do not understand
a rough neighborhood.
Bad. I mean, I'm not being just rough, right, but I mean bad. I mean, you had to go out and my friends, as you can imagine, in growing up, my best friend, my longest friends in the world are African American. We were all scared together. It wasn't about black or white. I mean, we stuck in groups, right, all of us together when we walked through Irving Park. It was not a place you went at night. Mm-hmm. When I campaigned for this office originally, I was given a choice of going door to door in any neighborhood I want, and I picked 8th and Siskiyou is where I started, next to the park. And what I was struck with, walking up and down from 8th Avenue next to the tennis courts all the way to Lloyd Center, and then back the other side of 8th, and then up 9th to Lloyd Center, and then back to Irving Park, was how many people were out, particularly at dusk, with children walking in the park. Mm-hmm. And so I would go to a community forum and have the questions, Joanne, you're asking me, people like, pissed off that there wasn't affordable housing. I said, but I hear that, mm-hmm, but you also have to hear that there has been some success here. And what we're really having is a discussion about the impact of our success. The success is that we had kind of a PDC model in the 60s called model cities, mm-hmm, that was used in inner Northeast Portland to have happened what has happened, to improve the neighborhood so there was less crime, it was more livable, people felt safe outside, businesses felt good about opening. You had a Union Avenue back in the late 60s and 70s that was boarded up, shut away, people ran from. You today have a thriving community. Having said that, why can't we do that and still have a place where the people that I grew up with can afford to buy a house? That's the challenge. Thus, I talk about these narrower houses. And the reason that I think that these are important for the community to talk about is they do provide an opportunity to have a working class family live in a great neighborhood now.
Do you know what those houses cost, though? They're $250 to start. Yes. What working families starting off can buy those?
All right. It's a horrible dilemma. The alternative is to move out a little further, like into Brentwood, Darlington, to Lentz, which are challenged neighborhoods. You can still get a good buy, but guess what you're buying? You're buying into a neighborhood that was like Irvington 25 and 30 years ago. It's a dilemma. Mm-hmm. It is a horrible dilemma.
Well, and let me add a little piece to that. The reason why folks weren't able to fix up their properties and own businesses was, of course, banks were redlining. They weren't allowing people that lived in those areas because mm-hmm. any area deemed gang territory, right. you know, no
oh,
matter.
This is pre-gang I'm talking about.
I know,
this
you're talking, I know, you're talking pre-gang. But, you know, I moved here in the 90s. I moved here January 1st, 1990. And at that time, no matter who you talk to, they said, don't go to Northeast Portland, yeah. right? Because, you
That's
know,
right.
it's bad in Northeast Portland.
That's
well, of
right.
course, I went and got a job in Northeast Portland, got a house in Northeast Portland, and have been in Northeast Portland ever since.
Right.
But if I'd have listened to the certified smart people, right, I'd have gone somewhere else because, you know, the media right. perception was that, you know, it was all gang territory
see, Joanne,
all the time.
That decision you made mm-hmm. was a decision made by thousands of people.
Exactly.
And people that moved in the neighborhood like you and Skip
right.
are what gave inspiration to others to move into the neighborhood. You see that dynamic. And so that's called success. And we have to acknowledge that to the extent right. that we had people like you and Skip move into the neighborhood mm-hmm. and others who were there to stake out a place for themselves and improve their future. We succeeded in Northeast Portland. We got to give ourselves a little credit for that. The challenge is not to criticize that, but rather how do we open up that opportunity to working class people to move back into the neighborhood? My mom and dad bought that house in 1952. Mm-hmm. They could not buy the house I grew up in today.
That's right.
Yeah. And the same kind of job my dad had.
That's right. Neither. Yeah, we couldn't live where we are now neither. So back to my question about PDC.
Yeah.
Should their role not shift to be more focused on how do you support homegrown businesses expanding and getting better and getting stronger, supporting community residents and being able to afford homes, whether that's, you know, providing, you know, second mortgages, providing down payment assistance, et cetera, et cetera. Should they not be focused on trying to bring businesses in from out of state with big tax breaks and big you know, with all the benefits mm-hmm. that they give to those big businesses, I think if this is an organization that's responsible for utilizing our tax dollars, the reality is that the people who pay those taxes in Northeast Portland have never benefited from those tax dollars. They're not benefiting from those dollars. They've been forced
out. Now, don't get me in the place where I actually have to defend PDC.
Do that to me, Joanne. Well, if you've got to go
what
there, you've got to go
what
there.
What hair I have left will fall out if you make me do that. Because out of fairness, uh-huh. I do not think that's accurate. I do think that in particularly Northeast Portland, mm-hmm. that's kind of the point of right. my longer term observation about Northeast Portland is there has been success and PDC has been at the front of that. And I got to give them a little credit for that because the Portland that I grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, mm-hmm. and my world was the world you live in now.
Right.
That's my world. Is not the same world as it is today.
That's
that is
true.
In large measure due to the work of PDC, and I got to give them credit for that.
But I got to say though, I disagree. I mean, in the years that you grew up there,
mm-hmm.
You know, there was that clear racial divide. 15th was the racial divide.
Mm-hmm.
If you were black, you didn't go on this side of
that's
15th,
right?
You stayed on the other side.
And guess which side I was on?
You were on the other side. Which is why I feel you.
Yeah, that's right.
but having said that, I mean, living there in the 90s when all the development started,
yeah.
it wasn't about how do we find local community members,
I see.
Support their efforts
yeah.
to expand their business,
yeah.
support their efforts
right.
to open businesses in the neighborhood.
I think that that's
it
right.
It wasn't about that.
No, you're right.
That,
okay.
Right?
On that point, I agree with you. And I will tell you, why I think that might be, and I'm trying to give them the benefit of the doubt on some of this,
okay.
is that we do draw urban renewal areas.
Yes.
And within those areas, we expect a lot of them.
That's right.
We expect in Lentz, for an example, that they do a better job than what they had been. And I will tell you, that having spent a lot of time in both communities, mm-hmm. Inner Northeast Portland and Lentz is the area that has the challenges right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
They need
no question.
All of the efforts PDC and resources has focused on. When I have a criticism of PDC,
right.
it's not that they're not helping Inner Northeast Portland more. It's that you need to focus on places like Lentz where you have true poverty.
Mm-hmm.
You have unpaved streets. Lentz has challenges. The neighborhood I grew up in, never envisioned.
Right,
we
right.
always had sidewalks.
That's right. That's
we
right.
always had paved streets.
That's
we
right.
always had parks.
Right.
Lentz is heartbreaking at times. I ride my bike home through Lentz a lot, and I purposely go through some of the neighborhoods. It makes me angry.
Mm-hmm.
Angry to see how we have some neighbors living in the city of Portland right now. I mean, you could be, honestly, right, in Appalachia when you look at some of these inner neighborhoods of Lentz.
Yes.
Particularly, I'm thinking between, for any of your listeners that want to know what I'm talking about, between Foster and Holgate, between I-205 and 122nd, mm-hmm, is the conditions are abysmal. And PDC is focusing there. On the other other focuses, PDC, we just passed a resolution sponsored by Commissioner Sen requiring 30% of every urban renewal area dollars be spent on affordable housing.
Right. That's huge.
And because we agree with you that they were focusing too much of their resources on issues that weren't helping working class people.
Right.
And tip the hat to Commissioner Sten. He focused on this, brought it along, got it passed here a couple weeks ago. So now every urban renewal area, and it doesn't matter if it's a downtown area or if it's a Pearl or whatever, 30% of the money in that area generated has to go to affordable housing.
Wonderful. 503-231-8187. We got a lot of callers. I'm sorry, callers, but I had to get my question out there.
Good question.
Good morning, caller. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello.
Hello. You're on.
Yes, I want to criticize the... I wish that the commissioners would just pay attention to running the city of Portland, not getting involved with biodiesel. You know, they're not technically qualified to do anything of this stuff. Perhaps people in Metro are, because they're running buses. But, you know, that somebody says housing, I mean, schools, just living in Portland, we don't need to be involved with creating a biodiesel industry. I mean, somebody with money is going to do that. Now, whether if you want to be prepared to buy the stuff, but I hear too much of all this, of getting involved with these biodiesel and hydrogen. Just how do we clear the streets? One of the things about East Portland, here's an example of developing. This is east of 45th, near, Crystal Springs, or that way. I think there was a project of getting people on sewer. So there were a lot of unpaved streets over there,
mm-hmm,
and houses where apparently people didn't have very much income. So I guess it was an affordable place to have a house. So when this came in, the next thing that happened, they had to put in sidewalks. And I asked one group of people, did you ever vote on this? Oh, no. Did you want it? No. Of course, they're out of there now, and the house is gone. And a better house is in its place.
I wonder if I could take a shot at one point you made to try to address, and that is, what's the connection between, for instance, biodiesel and my responsibility as a member of the council? I think that part of my responsibility is to make Portland economically a more viable place, and to the extent I can, make sure when you breathe in air in the city that you bring in breathing the cleanest air possible. We have learned lately that the federal government has dropped the ball on that in terms of the benzene and gasoline. So I think it's appropriate for the council to try to work to preserve the health of its citizens by trying to up the regulations on benzene. On biodiesel, what we're trying to do is not substitute what the private sector does, but rather create a market in the city of Portland for biodiesel that then causes farmers to grow the canola that we could ship to Portland that would go to a private sector plant. And we are working with a couple of companies that are interested in building a biodiesel plant in Portland, not just because it's a fun project, but because it creates jobs, family-paying jobs that generates income tax to the state and property tax to the city and the schools in the county. So I do think that I understand why some people might think, and I've heard this before, well, what is a city commissioner doing getting focused on biodiesel? Jobs.
Right.
Economic development, cleaner air in the city of Portland. We live in a bowl in the valley, and that bowl gets filled with pollutants. To the extent we can do anything locally to improve the conditions of the air in that bowl, that is our responsibility.
Well, I guess I guess all it serves to show is that running a government is much more complicated than running a business, because you've got to do so many more things at once. And I don't really know how you prioritize everything.
That is a whole other question.
That's a question.
You're about going to make me cry
if I do that.
Thank you so much. And you know, and you did come to a really excellent realization right there, is that you're right. You know, the difference between being a public servant and actually really thinking about how you leave the city better than it was when you came in to serve in that position is a huge task and responsibility.
So, and then the politician has to get up and get elected.
Yeah.
Well, and the person in business, it's not quite that way.
That's right.
That's
right. Because if you own the business, you know, your employees are going to do what you tell them to do if they want to keep their job.
Yeah.
Right? That's the bottom line. Whereas if you're elected leader, you got to make the case that you deserve to continue on or be promoted to another position.
So not so much emphasis on biodiesel, please.
Well, it's the future. It's the future, and it's coming. So we can
Make jobs for Portlanders.
Living wage jobs for Portland.
And we're actually working with the Port of Portland, and we're working with other organizations in the state that are farmer-based, agrarian-based. And the goal is to make Portland actually an exporter of a biodiesel product so that that product comes through Portland and our ports. Our longshore folks get jobs. These are brand-new jobs we're talking about at these biodiesel plants along the river. So I think in the next couple of years, most people who have had questions about this will understand that this is not just a feel-good initiative. This is cold, hard cash for farmers, for Portlanders, and for our economy.
Thank you so much.
Now, I know.
Have a good day.
Yes, thank you, caller. I know your time's running short, but I want to get in a question about the resolution on
the
Iraq war.
Yes, the war resolution, yes.
I know our listeners want to hear about that.
Yes.
Well, you know, I had a group come in to visit with me that talked to me about sponsoring a resolution calling for the withdrawal of all our troops in Iraq. And I think I shocked them when I just almost immediately said I would not only be pleased to do that, I actually feel a certain responsibility to do that. And the reason is because 4 years ago, Commissioner Stanton introduced a resolution at council calling for on the United States not to do any aggressive acts with respect to Iraq until the UN authorized it. And I voted against that at the time. And the reason I voted against that at the time was, I think, like most Americans, we heard Colin Powell, and I remember I watched, because I knew this issue was coming up at council, I watched on PBS his entire testimony in front of the United Nations. I have a lot of respect for Colin Powell. I still have a lot of respect for Colin Powell, particularly when he said later that he was lied to on the evidence that he presented. I respected that. So while I thought that I was voting to preserve the ability of the United States to protect our partners in the Middle East, specifically Israel, from being attacked with either atomic bombs or some kind of chemical bomb, we later learned that we were all lied to. And I have it is one of the few votes in my public life I deeply, deeply regret. And so I just think it's right, and it actually, I think, allows me to set better for myself this whole issue of resolutions at the council by me bringing this forward. So in about 2 weeks, we'll have a hearing that will adopt calling for the withdrawal of troops from Iraq, and sooner rather than later. And you would think that with the Democratic Congress now, that might not be necessary. But if you've been following the debates in Congress of the Democrat elects,
right.
This is an issue that they need to hear from us about. And we need to be clear about it, that we, you know, our national interest right now is not tied to Iraq's national interest. The only reason we're over there, I think, is this constant quest that has driven our country and others to seek a reliable source of petroleum products. It kind of ties back to my biodiesel initiative. It's one of the inspirations for that, is mm-hmm. this whole understanding on a lot of our parts that we are embroiled in these international conflicts that cost the lives of young men and women, that have some incalculable cost to our future, because we'll never know what they were going to produce for us. For what purpose? Nobody can really give a legitimate purpose, so...
That's absolutely right. So coming up today on KBOO at 9 is Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, hear an interview with John Ross, writer and journalist living in Mexico. And at 10 is DIY, Portland. This month, the show goes technical and explores the world of open source software with guests from Free Geek, other local organizations working to provide alternatives to the world of Microsoft. And at 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard speaks with members of the Northwest Print Council. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, an Argentine torture survivor talks about her return to the police station where she was abused, and an editor at the Los Angeles Times discussed how he was forced out of his job after he rejected job cuts. That's what's coming up today on KBOO. One more announcement, the documentary Left to Die, Causeway Concentration Camp, New Orleans, USA, 2005, by Portland filmmaker Elizabeth Outley, will be held over one more day at the Baghdad Theater, 3702 Southeast Hawthorne. The documentary, which features several people who were held in prison camp-like conditions at a freeway intersection in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, will play at 6 p.m. today, Thursday, November 16th. That's what's coming up today on KBOO and other places. We've got lots of callers on the line in less than 5 minutes. So, callers, I'm going to ask you to be short, sweet, and to the point. Thank you, caller. Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
Yes, I'll try to be. First of all, about the PDC. You know, when black people first moved from Vanport over to Northeast Portland, first of all, white people moved out of that area. And back in those days, the police and the news coverage together drove the prices of houses in Northeast Portland so down until they wasn't even worth much.
That's right.
And Joanne is right. Black people couldn't get loans because of redlining. And so it wasn't until all this money came from Congress to Portland to build more houses that things changed. Back in those days, PDC used to have homestead programs where people could bid on homes or enter a drawing and get homes. And so they was doing everything they could to build that area up. And I'm aware of model cities and all that because my uncle was a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when land became, in the inner cities, became valuable, and now white people didn't want to live in suburbia no more. They wanted to live in inner cities close to their jobs and things of that nature. Then they wanted to reclaim that area. So what the city did, instead of putting in training programs or sending in social workers, because it was a little rough over there at the time, where Fred Myers used to be, they built a police station.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first sign, you know, when white people want something, they're going to bring in a fort and set it up, and they're going to go out, and they're going to get rid of the natives. So when they put that police station over there, that was the first step towards gentrification. Then PDC came out with the tax abatements. They never had tax abatements when black people was trying to buy houses. When they switched the tax abatements, now when the new buyers come over there and buy, their property taxes are frozen for so many years. So they're encouraging now gentrification. The city is doing this, PDC. Also, too, and the police have a hand in this.
So I'm going to ask you to ask the question.
I'm just saying that he's basically wrong when he talks about the way Portland was back in those days. On Union Avenue, at the time, there was thriving businesses on that street, black businesses. And Union Avenue didn't get boarded up until after they had the riot. They had a riot back in the 60s. And then all the businesses moved out after the riot. He didn't tell you about the riot. But one last thing,
I don't disagree with anything you're saying, and I remember Weimer's Hardware, I remember all of the businesses along Union that did board up and move out, Fred Myers moved out. What I would tell you was, you're trying to present it like it's a black versus white issue. That's not true. There were black people that lived in my neighborhood that were as scared, as afraid of what was going on around them as the white people were.
One last thing, I gotta go, because there's no reason to go to the mayor, he's a figurehead. We already know that the police union has the power, and the DA. These people hold the real power. The mayor is just a figurehead. That Foxworth incident proved that he can't stand up under public pressure. And the woman who's over the police now is a clear indication that white women are the ones that's benefiting from civil rights, not the
And on that note, I'm going to have to ask you. Gotta go. All right. Have a great day. One more caller. Caller, please do not emulate the previous caller. Please be short, sweet, and to the point because we are at the end of our time. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wondered if you had any comments regarding the community of Linton who keeps trying to, they keep coming up with these grandiose ideas on what could save their community.
Mm-hmm.
And the
Good
latest
question.
I hear is a Costco, which a lot of us are just floored about. I live out in that area, and I'll take my answer offline. Thank you
so much.
Well, First of all, the basic premise that Linton needs to be saved is not one I agree with. It is a wonderful community, that people choose to live in because of its unique character and up on the hill and the switchback roads. And I disagree with that. I also, unfortunately, I've spent more time meeting with the neighbors in Linton on the issue of the housing on the waterfront, and now I've had some meetings on this Costco thing than any other issue, and I just cannot agree with them. And fundamentally, it has nothing to do with anything other than the site that this is, the Costco is being proposed for and the housing is being proposed for is between two gasoline tank storage facilities and built over the Olympic pipeline that then has a railroad track crossing through the property so that people inside could virtually be trapped inside if something happened. So I've tried to be as polite and as customer friendly as I've urged the employees that I'm responsible for to be, but firm. I will not agree on a Costco on that site or any housing on that site. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror if I did.
It's been fabulous having you here. Thank you so much, Commissioner Leonard.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
And I want to tell you, Dave, it's wonderful to have you back. Thank you for being here with me today. You've been listening to Voices from the Edge. We'll see you next week, same time, same place, same channel.
Have a good one.
Bye now.